6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Venezuela has deployed hundreds of troops to the rest of border state of Táchira after weeks of anti-government protests. The South American country is in the midst of a deepening economic and political crisis. The UN Security Council took up the matter Wednesday in closed-doors session. Venezuela's ambassador, Rafael Ramirez Carino, rejected the meeting.
We are out of the Security Council agenda because we never will be on a threat against the peace and security in international or in the regional level.
But U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said the humanitarian situation is dire and needs to be addressed.
What we attempted to do in this meeting today is about prevention. We've been down this road with Syria, with North Korea, with South Sudan, with Burundi, with Burma. We've been down this road, and rather waiting for a serious situation where we have to have it in an open Security Council meeting, why not get in front of this?
Peter Hakim, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue, describes the root cause of the crisis.
The core is just total mismanagement by the government, sort of defying any sort of rules of the game regarding democracy, throwing out any kind of serious approach to economic matters.
Socialist President Nicolas Maduro has blamed the opposition, saying it's seeking his ouster. The opposition has demanded new elections and called for foreign aid as well as the release of political prisoners. Nigeria says another schoolgirl abducted by the insurgents group Boko Haram from Chibok has escaped more than 3 years after a mass kidnapping of more than 200 girls. This is VOA News. The former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Robert Mueller, has been named special prosecutor to oversee the investigation of alleged Russian influence in last year's election. The decision follows demands for an independent probe into charges Moscow tried to sway the outcome in favor of then-candidate Donald Trump. Republican Senator James Lankford welcomed the move.
You've got a prime decision maker there working within the process. It's a good hybrid to be able to keep the career folks at FBI, to be able to make sure they can continue to do their job, but you have an independent person as the final decision maker in the direction.
Mr. Trump, who has denied the allegations, said a thorough investigation will confirm what's already known. There was no collusion. In a commencement address Wednesday to cadets of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, the president imparted some advice as he criticized media coverage of his young presidency.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
He said adversity makes one stronger. Don't give in, he added. Don't back down. Never stop doing what you know is right. The Syrian opposition is seeking an extension of the 4 days for the latest round of peace talks in Geneva. Their spokesman is Salim El-Meslet.
Our purpose here is to find a political solution. We're not here to find a military solution. A military solution really cost us lives there. Every single day we lose lives.
He said the opposition needs time to respond to a proposal for a draft constitution by UN envoy Stefan de Mistura. Previous rounds have made little progress in ending the six-year conflict. Newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday named his cabinet with a mix of men and women spanning the political spectrum. Former Socialist Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian has been named foreign minister. He joins conservative Prime Minister Edouard Philippe, right as Bruno Le Maire was named economy minister. The new defense chief is 59-year-old centrist Sylvie Goulard. Norway's prime minister has said a citizen jailed for life in Democratic Republic of Congo for murder and espionage has been freed and allowed to return home. Joshua French was convicted, along with another Norwegian, of killing a Congolese driver and spying in 2009. Both denied the charges. The other Norwegian died in prison. Japan Tuesday posted 2.2% growth in the year's first quarter, the fifth straight quarterly expansion, the longest growth period in the world's third largest economy in a decade. The country's growth attributed to strong exports, along with spending ahead of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Candidates in Kenya's August 8th election are asked to begin submitting lists of their supporters by today, Thursday.
Our constitution requires that for a person to run for a presidential seat, we need to have a total of 48,000 supporters. And these have to be at least 2,000 supporters from 24 counties.
Roslyn Kwamboka Akombe is a member of Kenya's Independent Electoral Commission. A cholera outbreak compounds hunger crisis in southern Somalia. Activists say Sudan's President Bashir should answer to war crimes accusations, not socializing with other Islamic leaders. And the only female candidate in Liberia's 2017 elections says if elected, she will serve all Liberians.
Whether you're a countryman's child or you're a Gonga man's child, I want to see to it that every child has access to education. I want to see to it that we have less infant mortality. I want to see to it that we build medical institutions that will care for every citizen of Liberia.
That's Mandela Cooper of the Union of Liberian Democrats Party. African diaspora in Portugal finds bits of home in music and salons, and solo power gains popularity in Africa. The stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission has called on presidential candidates to start submitting a list of their supporters beginning today, Thursday, ahead of the August 8th general election. The list should contain a total of 48,000 supporters across the country to meet a constitutional requirement, and it will be used in the qualification process. Commissioner Roslyn Kwamboka Akombe tells viewers Peter Clotty that the presidential candidates have to present the list of only registered voters before the end of May 22nd.
Our constitution requires that for a person to run for a presidential seat, we need to have a total of 48,000 supporters. And these have to be at least 2,000 supporters from 24 counties. So that is a requirement in law, and those 48,000 supporters have to be registered voters. So that is a requirement, and what we ask the political parties to do is to try and submit to us those names between the 18th and the 22nd to allow us to screen them through our software to make sure that they are registered voters, that they belong to the party for which they are supporting a presidential candidate. So that is why we're asking them to provide us the information in advance, so that by the time we have a meeting with them on the 23rd, we are able to ascertain that they have met all the requirements and if there's anything that they need to do to make any amendments, they are able to make those amendments.
Well, in certain countries, names have been presented, and then it is realized that some names that have been presented have endorsed two or more candidates. How do you intend resolving this?
Peter, that is why we're trying to do this in advance, so that you don't get yourself at the last minute on the 28th of May with a situation like that. And the law also provides some space for people to be able to make amendments.
The candidates, I understand, would have to attend pre-nomination meetings on May 23rd at the venue that the IEBC will determine. What is the significance of this pre-nomination meeting?
The pre-nomination meeting is very important, actually. This is where we go through with the candidates the various requirements in the law. We appraise them of all the requirements in the law, the things that we will be looking at before we clear them, because we are supposed to have to clear them by the 28th of May. But we do not want to leave anything to chance. We want to make sure that we go through all those requirements in the law, all the requirements, integrity requirements, so that they're aware of the criteria that we'll be using to make a final determination of who the presidential candidates will be on the 28th of May.
Talking about the nomination, between 28th to 29th of May, is that when the IEBC will determine who qualifies? And if you determine that there are some problems with your nomination document, will there be any additional time for them to rectify these problems that you possibly could find?
Yes, there is room for them to be able to make any changes and resubmit any documents that we require from them. But I think what is also important to stress is that in case we rule against a candidate for whatever reason, they also have room to be able to lodge any cases they might have, any disputes they might have. We have a period of time to be able to hear any of the complaints that may arise from the nomination process.
So talk to me about disputes that could arise surrounding the registration of candidates. How does the IEBC plan to resolve this?
Actually, Peter, I'm just coming from a very intensive training that we've been having as commissioners on dispute resolution. And we have a dispute resolution mechanism. They have to lodge those complaints. They have to write to the commission. The commission has a quasi-judicial role or position in our system. And that is why the chairman of the IEBC has to be somebody qualified to be a judge to be able to also hear those cases. So they have an opportunity to be able to lodge those cases with us. But they also have other mechanisms. They could go to the High Court. They could also go to the political parties dispute tribunal, PPDC, that exists. And these disputes could range from us turning back their education qualifications and saying that according to the Commission for University Education, you do not have a university degree from a recognized institution. It could be related to us saying you're not a member of this political party that you claim to have been to be coming from. It could be us turning back and saying these candidates, these supporters that you have, are not members of your party or they're not registered members. So there are a whole range of different that could arise out of the registration process.
Rosalind Kwamboka Akombe is a commissioner at Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. She spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. The only female candidate in the 2017 Liberian presidential election says she is in the race to win. This despite prediction by some that Magdalena Kupo of the Union of Liberian Democrats Party has no chance in a race that so far has 22 candidates with more to come. They cite the lack of voter familiarity with her candidacy, but some say in an era where non-traditional candidates are winning races, Ms. Cooper could be Liberia's second female elected president. Cooper was the guest Wednesday on VOA Straight Talk Africa television program with host Chaka Sally, along with me. Cooper says her candidacy embraces all Liberians, irrespective of their economic or ethnic background.
There is a Liberia that exists that has been what James talked about, a Liberia that has benefited a few individuals in the country. My idea for Liberia is a Liberia for Liberians first. Today, there is a Liberian that's enjoyed by everyone else but Liberians. Propagandists have used tribalism, political affiliation, economics, to divide the Liberian people. So James spoke earlier about this whole native and Konga man scenario, which still exists. See, I'm a new generation of Liberians who don't care about the tribal, the political, or the economic status. I gain the privilege I've gained in life through education and hard work. And that is the message I'm sharing across the board. It's Liberia first, not the Lofa man first, or the Grand Judean man first. All those things that have been used to hold our people back is of the past, according to my generation. So Liberians' voters are much smarter in 2017 than they were 2005 and 11. And come October 10th, 2017, the Liberian people are going to vote for the person who they feel will bring Liberians together, unite Liberia, build a strong economy. But before we do that, we have to create basic services across the board for all persons that call themselves a Liberian, irrespective of their tribal affiliation. And that is the Liberia I want to build that will benefit every person, leaving no child uneducated, whether you're a countryman's child or you're a Konga man child. I want to see to it that every child has access to education. I want to see to it that we have less infant mortality. I want to see to it that we build medical institutions that will care for every citizen of Liberia.
First of all, tell me, first, your political party. And I wonder if you're thinking about a coalition with other parties.
Absolutely. My political party is the Union of Liberian Democrats. It's a very small grassroots party that I came in and revitalized. And we have built a movement with the right message for the Liberian people. And number two, I do plan to join a coalition, but a correlation and with a party that preach the same message that I'm preaching. There are a lot of parties that make a lot of noise. They have a lot of people around them. They call themselves the biggest parties, but they're preaching all the wrong message to the Liberian people, message of divides, message of if we don't get it, the whole country will be destroyed. This is not the time the international community is watching us.
There's something called the 10-year residency clause in the Liberian Constitution.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Have you resided in Liberia 10 consecutive years before you decided to run for the president?
I started the foundation's efforts in 2003.
Yeah.
In 2005, I moved back home. Mm-hmm. And as a result of the lack of opportunities and resources in Liberia, mm-hmm. I oftentimes frequent in the Western world to raise funds and go back and do my work. So, of course, indeed, I've been in Liberia since 2005, and I have all the records to show that.
Ms. Cooper, these are some of the issues that are driving the discussion now, before we get into the political movement officially. The issue of the code of conduct.
Sure.
The issue of whether some of the candidates have a dual citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
What's your view on dual citizenship? Do you have a U.S. citizenship?
Well, when I entered the gates of Newark, New Jersey, I was given a green card, which I still am very privileged to have. So I don't think that's considered dual citizenship. Is that?
Are you a U.S. citizen?
I have a green card.
When I say a U.S., have you raised your hand to say that you pledge allegiance to the United States?
I don't recall doing so. Well, you have a green card, you don't do that, right?
Well, eventually some people, they have green cards and they become
U.S. citizens. But I didn't answer your question.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you were to become president,
sure.
What would you do about the issue of dual nationality, really? A country like Liberia,
sure.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Pretty much a creation, frankly, of a diaspora of sorts. 1847, you become independent, and up to today, you don't allow dual nationality.
Well, to me, that's something that has to be revisited, because if you look at our economy, we have an 85% underemployment rate. Our economy is being supported by foreign aid, but the Liberians in the diaspora who have access to U.S. citizenship are the ones who are scrubbing floors across America, are the ones who are cleaning bathrooms, are the ones who are taking care of the senior citizens of America and sending the hard-earned paychecks home to take care of their families when government cannot do it. So to exempt them from the process of Liberia, to me, it's not a smart idea. So I, Migdela Cooper, will welcome every Liberian, irrespective of whether you carry two passports or one. You are a Liberian, and you will enjoy the benefits of Liberia. And if you do attempt to participate in the political arena, you have every right because you've been funding our economy. And we want more Liberians funding Liberian economy than our foreign partners. That's how you become an independent nation.
So what's your relationship with George Weah?
George Weah, like every other candidate in the race, are very good friends of mine. I'm a new breed of politician that believe politics is just an idea. When we're done discussing politics, we go talk about other things pertaining to our country. So George Weah is a very good friend. So is Alex Cumming, and so is Joseph Boakai, and everybody else in the race. I have no enemies. You know, everybody's my friend.
That was Liberian female presidential candidate Migdela Cooper of the Union of Liberian Democrats Party. She was the guest Wednesday on VOA Straight Talk Africa television program with host Shaka Saleh and me. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 18 minutes past the hour. Analysts and rights advocates are expressing concern about reports that Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been invited to a summit this weekend in Saudi Arabia, which U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to attend. The invitation to Bashir has stirred controversy as the Sudanese leader has been charged with war crimes by the International Criminal Court. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
The International Criminal Court considers Omar al-Bashir a fugitive from justice and has sought his arrest since 2009. Elise Kepler, an associate director at Human Rights Watch, says interactions between a U.S. president and an alleged war criminal would send what she calls a terrible signal.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been charged by the International Criminal Court with the most grave crimes under international law, for alleged responsibility for abuses in Darfur. The charges are genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. There really is nothing more serious.
Eric Reeves, senior fellow at Harvard University's FXB Center for Health and Human Rights, says Trump should boycott the event altogether.
To the extent that Bashir can travel without problem, it weakens the ICC, and so Trump is contributing to that with his presence.
Calls to Sudan's foreign minister and government spokesman for response went unanswered. David Bosco is an associate professor at Indiana University and an expert on the International Criminal Court. He says Saudi Arabia has welcomed Bashir in the past.
So this isn't a departure from Saudi policy on Bashir, but it is, of course, notable that he's being invited to a kind of summit where President Trump would be present. And U.S. officials have not met with Bashir, and they've had a policy of avoiding meeting with Bashir. And so Saudi Arabia's put the United States in a difficult position here.
Bosco adds that the Trump administration's position toward the ICC is still vague.
It is important to recognize that we're in a different world with the Trump administration regarding the ICC than we were with the Obama administration. The Obama administration, while, you know, it wasn't going to push to join the court, was fairly friendly toward it. The Trump administration, it's much less clear, you know, how friendly this administration is going to be to the court.
The United States is not a member of the ICC, but a State Department official provided a statement that the U.S. opposes invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by any person subject to outstanding ICC arrest warrants, including President Bashir. The U.S. lifted some sanctions against Sudan in January, with then-President Barack Obama citing positive actions by the Sudanese government. A State Department official said there could be a permanent revocation of sanctions in 6 months if progress continued. Since his indictment, Bashir has traveled to ICC member countries such as South Africa and Jordan, which have a legal obligation to arrest him, but so far have not. Because Saudi Arabia is not a member of the ICC, the country does not have the same obligation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A regional drought has displaced over 500,000 people in Somalia and left the country at risk of famine. A cholera outbreak is further complicating relief efforts, in particular in the southern part of the country, where some villages remain under Al-Shabaab control. Mohammed Yusuf reports from the town of Baidoa.
5-year-old Fatuma was admitted to the hospital after experiencing stomach pain, vomiting and diarrhea. Her mother says she can't lose another child.
My eldest daughter was suffering from diarrhea, and she died 2 months ago in the Busli village on the outskirts of Baidoa. I left my youngest daughter at home. I am the mother of three. My deceased daughter was 7 years old.
Aid agencies say the areas worst hit by cholera and hunger are villages like Busli, which are under Al-Shabaab control. Accessing them is a challenge. Tens of thousands of people have walked to government-controlled areas like Baidoa to seek help. Somalia has reported more than 40,000 cases of cholera since January. More than half the cases have been in this part of the country, the southwest federal state. And according to the World Health Organization, most of the cholera victims have been malnourished children. Health workers say rains this month in southern and central Somalia have contributed to a fresh surge in cholera cases. At this hospital, the biggest in the region, a special ward treats dozens of patients weak with from disease.
It's like when the cholera outbreak started and we had many patients. Last week we were hopeful about 5 patients would come, but now between 8 a.m. and noon every morning we get at least 16 new patients. The situation is getting worse.
More than 150,000 displaced people are now living in makeshift camps around the town, and more continue to arrive. Clean water is available, but it's not enough. Medics supported by UNICEF and the WHO are going around in the camps to provide oral cholera vaccination. At the main hospital, people continue to arrive seeking treatment. Nationwide, between 200 and 300 cases of cholera are being reported every day. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Baidoa, Somalia.
In a small corner of the Ribolara neighborhood outside of Portugal's capital, Lisbon, the sights and sounds of Africa reign supreme. Ricky Stryer visited the area and spoke to African immigrants to see how they are dealing with homesickness.
The sounds of Guinea-Bissau music spill out from a bar named Obama Cafe. This small restaurant serves up African dishes, but it is thousands of miles from Bissau. This tiny dead-end corner on the outskirts of Lisbon, Portugal, is an oasis where African diaspora living in Portugal can be reminded of home. The owner of Obama Cafe, Ba Kutubo, says places like this are important for immigrants living in Europe. Originally from Guinea-Bissau, Kutubo says musicians from Guinea-Bissau, Cabo Verde, and Angola gather to play music at his bar every week. It can help with the homesickness, he adds. Kutubo says he does miss his country because it's been 3 years since he was last there. But political problems keep him from going back. Next door to the cafe, Ana Maria Fernandez stands in her salon, washing a customer's hair. Originally from Cabo Verde, Fernandez says she came to Lisbon to get better work, though since the financial crisis, her earnings have decreased. Most of her customers are from former Portuguese colonies in Africa. Even though she has been in Lisbon for 17 years, she says she will always be Cabo Verdean.
Ser Cabo Verdean é tudo. Eu adoro mesmo meu país.
She adds Cabo Verde is everything for her, saying she loves her country. Bar owner Ba says he actually feels more Portuguese because he has been living in Lisbon longer than he lived in Guinea-Bissau. According to the 2011 census, there are nearly 100,000 residents in Portugal from the country's former African colonies. Whether they feel more African or more Portuguese, they can come to this corner outside of Lisbon and hear the sounds of home. Ricky Shryock for VOA, Lisbon.
It looks like the time has finally come for residents across Africa to start using their most abundant natural power source. While building power plants and transmission lines takes years and costs much more, installing solar panels is quicker and more affordable for individual homeowners, businesses, and farmers. Viewer George Putish reports.
Solar panels are appearing everywhere in Kenya, from shopping malls and residential homes to farms.
Kenya, lying on the equator, has some of the best solar insulation in the globe. I think it's about 4.5 kilowatts per hour, so which is actually very good. And if the solar energy is well harnessed, it could actually help in stability of our grid, particularly when we have solar during the day.
A regulation adopted in 2012 required all property developers in Kenya to install solar water heaters in buildings where occupants use over 100 liters of hot water a day.
Everyone is making sure that they install a solar system during the time of building. So this has worked to the advantage of solar contractors in Kenya, and which in turn means more business for us.
Residents say the use of solar panels considerably lowers their electric bills.
We're able to have hot water throughout the day, depending on the usage, and also in the night. Yeah, so we don't have to heat to put power on.
In this farmer's field, solar panels provide power for pumps, which ensure that elevated tanks are always filled with water. Gravity sends the water directly to the crop roots.
I used to have problems with water, but now I have none. Then I used to use a water pump, and during a dry spell, I never got a good harvest nor export. But now I'm exporting from January to December from the time I got the solar system installed.
The cost of solar power kits is still way beyond the reach of many ordinary Kenyans and other Africans, so they expect their governments to do more to help them.
If the government has a goodwill to subsidize, then you see the benefit of the registration that they have passed.
The Kenyan government promises it will soon launch a $150 million project to help local communities pay to install solar panels in markets, schools, shops, and homes in poor areas far from urban power grids. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission has called on presidential candidates to start submitting a list of their supporters beginning today, Thursday, ahead of the August 8th general election. That is it for this Thursday, May 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.